This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
I think many people find the story of my life fascinating, not just because I speak with an English accent, but because my mother is a Sephardi Jewess from Alexandria, and she was born and raised there in Egypt until she was 25 years old. And my father is a Pentecostal evangelical preacher. How did my parents come to meet? It was during the Second World War. My father was in the British Army, and he happened to be stationed in Alexandria. My grandmother, my Jewish grandmother, had 10 children. My mother is the eldest. Next was my Uncle Solomon. And after she had 7 children, each of them were born alive. Some of them lived for 1 or 2 months, some for 1 or 2 years. One little girl lived to be almost 4. For reasons best known to God, each one of these children passed away. When my grandmother was carrying the 10th child, the rabbi in Alexandria suggested to my grandparents not to prepare anything for the unborn baby, that it should not be an evil eye, just to rely on gifts from the community. When the child was born and it was a boy, they suggested again, the rabbi said, to call his name Chaim, life, and he would live. They called him Chaim Shmuel. And my grandfather took upon himself a vow that if that child would live, he would fast every Monday and Thursday for the duration of his life. My grandfather was true to that vow, and my Uncle Sammy lived. During these difficult years for my grandparents, and especially for my grandmother, any mother among us this evening could understand the terrible emotional and physical stress that she must have gone through in carrying these children, looking after them, and then unfortunately burying them. During those years, for many years, my grandmother was teaching in a Christian boarding school, a Salvation Army boarding school. She was teaching English in Alexandria. Knowing the way that the Christians want nothing more, as we have heard, than to convert a Jew, I know that the headmaster of that school must have day after day constantly harassed my grandmother, telling her if she would only believe in the Christian Messiah, her inner pain would cease. Unfortunately, by the time my grandmother was about 45 years old and my mother was about 20, they both converted to Christianity. My grandfather was so devastated, as anyone could imagine. My mother at the Salvation Army mission in Alexandria met my father. They fell in love and became engaged. My father promised my mother when the war ended, he would send her a ticket to England where they could marry. They took about another 3.5 years, but true to his word, my father sent the ticket. When my mother boarded the boat at the age of 25, she crossed a vast ocean, away from her people and away from her heritage. I don't think it really even occurred to my mother quite how far that journey was going to take her away from her heritage. A very interesting comparison between my mother's life and my own was that I was 25 years old and I made the journey back. When my mother arrived on the shores of England, she was baptized into the church. They were married in church. It was as if my mother took the whole 25 years, first 25 years of her life, and stuffed them into a closet and securely locked the doors and either lost the key or chose never to open it. My father, having come through the whole war, and he was serving nine years in the British Army, many of his friends did not make it through. He felt there must be a reason why God had spared his life and not the lives of many of his friends. And so he decided to become a preacher. He trained and became a minister. And I'm the youngest of five children. And by the time I was born, my father's congregation was well established in a small town in England called Loughborough in Leicestershire. There was no synagogue there, and as far as I know, no Jews. We were raised according to the Christian teachings that because my father was not Jewish, we children were not Jewish. We were told that the rabbis had it wrong. According to God and according to the Holy Bible, we were not Jews. I never found any reason as a child to question that. We always went to Christian schools. We went to church almost every night of the week, twice on Saturdays and three times on Sunday. We had no television, no radio, no newspapers in our home. It was a strict puritanical upbringing. I never socialized except outside, other than in the church. And even though it might sound extremely austere and rigid, I want to make it very clear that I did not leave Christianity because it was hard for me. In fact, from when I was a young child, I always wanted to serve God. From when I was a little girl, I remember many times kneeling down by my bed and praying to God and saying, "When I get big, I want to earn a lot of money. I'll work very hard, and all the money I earn, I'll give it to you." I had this desire to commit myself to something and to serve God fully. So being raised in the Christian circles, in the Protestant circles, it wasn't any news to anyone that by the time I was 16 years old that I was already going off to theological college. I should have been 18, but it so happened that the principal of the college was serving in the British Air Force during the war, and he had known my grandmother and my mother from Alexandria. And so because he had known my mother for so many years, he accepted me as the youngest student in the college. This was a very big change for me. Being the baby at home, I was a little spoiled, very pampered on. And all of a sudden, I was thrust into an institutional environment in the big city. The principal of the college believed that he had heard from God. His mission in life was to take in young people, to work on their characters, and to train them how to work. He believed that unless a person's spirit was broken, then they would never be of total use to God. A person could not be totally submissive to the will of God unless his own spirit and own ambition was broken. In order to accomplish this goal, he had a lot of rules. When we first arrived in the college, we were given a book of rules. We had to take a covenant with these people, a vow, to say that we would stay with them until death did us part. Not only that, but we had to be obedient to those in authority over us, because they were like the shepherds of our soul, and they had reached a greater spiritual height, supposedly, and so they could help us to gain also a spiritual height. We had to eat anything that was put in front of us. It didn't matter if it was to us personally distasteful, remember one poor guy there could not stand cabbage. And he was constantly being served plates of cabbage that he had to finish. And this was in order to kill the natural desire in a person of lust for food. We had to fast a lot for spiritual purification and other things. It was compulsory to fast one day every week. We were encouraged to fast twice. Sometimes the principal would call upon us to fast 3 days in a row, sometimes 5 days or 7 days. The longest fast I ever did, I took upon myself, was to fast for 8 days. This was not a fast that we broke after sunset. It was a continual fast, but we were allowed to have drinks. Believe me, on the third day, you feel like you're going to die. If you get through the third day, then you can continue. But many times we would be humiliated in public, and this was in order to kill the self-pride in a person. Many times my husband would tease me and say, Tava, you know, I wouldn't have lasted a week, not even a couple of days, if it was me. The reason I stayed there was because in my naivety, in my simplicity, I really believed that by enduring all of this, two things were going to happen to me. One, I was going to become a better person. And in so doing, I was going to become closer to God. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to become as close to God as was humanly possible. I wanted to totally give myself over to Him, as I had mentioned. And so it didn't matter what I had to do. If it was good to eat rotten food or moldy bread or food that I personally did not like in order to work on my carnal nature and myself, then that was good, and I would do it, and I did it enthusiastically. And so I adjusted very quickly in the college, and I was very popular and well-loved. After I'd been there a couple of years, one of my elder sisters arrived in the college. She'd only been there about a month. And we crossed paths in the dining room one evening. And she whispered to me and she said, do you know what day it was today? I said, no, Margaret, because for us it was an ordinary day. She said it was Yom Kippur. I said, how do you... how do you know that? She said, well, she was at work, and she'd seen all the Jews going into the synagogue, and in her lunch break, she decided to go in and ask what's going on. They told her today is Yom Kippur, she said, thank you very much, she went back, she ate her sandwiches, and she continued with her work. I was flabbergasted. I said, synagogue? How do you know that there's a synagogue here? I've been in the city of Nottingham for 2 years, it hadn't even occurred to me to think about a Jew or a synagogue. She said, hey, you didn't know? It turned out that there was a synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue, literally a 5-minute walk away from our college, just down the little hill and around the corner, and there it was. Now, the only Jew I'd ever seen in my life to this time was my mother, or photographs of her family, who were then living in Israel. There was Sfardim, dark skin, black hair. Innocently, I thought, that's what Jews looked like. And if ever I saw anyone with dark skin and black hair, they must be a Jew. Well, my father was pure blonde and blue eyes. So all of us children are fair in complexion. I look at my sister, and I said, Margaret, didn't they look at you and say that you're a Gentile? She said, no, you know what? There's even Jews there with blonde hair. She said, and anyway, there are crowds of people there. And if you're so interested, why don't you go and have a look? Fine. We never had too much time to really think about or discuss too much because we always had a lot of work to do. So my sister went her way and I went to my room. I'll never forget that day. When I got to my room, all I could think was it was Yom Kippur. All the Jews were in synagogue, and you weren't there. Together with these words that seemed so strong in my mind and seemed to come from nowhere, was a deep feeling of sadness, like a feeling of depression. It seemed to encompass my whole being, and it aggravated me. So much so, I remember like making my arms rigid by my side and literally clenching my fists and saying to myself with all the strength I could muster within, so what? So what if all the Jews were in synagogue and I wasn't there? I wasn't supposed to be there. And what on earth have the Jews got to do with me? It's not my business. Do you know, for almost 3 days, I could not rid myself of these haunting words in my mind and this feeling of depression in the very gut of my life. I was only 18 years old, and I was so embarrassed to share it with anybody, because I thought it was like so weird. I figured they'd end me off. So I was panicking inside and desperately trying to like fight away these feelings. Finally, after about 3 days, I got through it, and I forgot about it, and I carried on with my life in the church. Several months, weeks, maybe a couple of months later, out of the blue, one Saturday morning, now we had a service that started on Saturday at 12 o'clock. We were supposed to prepare our soul for the service, like go to the library and study or pray quietly in the chapel. This one Saturday morning, I tried to persuade my roommate, who of course was not Jewish, to come with me for a walk. My sister told me there's a beautiful park in Arboretum. We often would go for a walk there, and immediately the other side was the synagogue. So I said to my roommate, come, let's go for a walk in the Arboretum, and then come with me 5 minutes, just to see what a synagogue looks like inside. Kept saying, synagogue? What do you want to go there for? No, I'm not going to a synagogue, she said. Well, my sister had promised me that there were crowds of people there, and no one had bothered her. So I decided I would go myself. Now, in this college, we had rules of modesty. First of all, our hair always, from the women, always had to be covered. So we had long headscarves. Then it was immodest to show this bone here on our wrist and to show our ankles, so we had clothes to the floor. This day I was dressed completely in dark brown, a long dark brown headscarf and these long robes all the way down to the floor. I always say I looked more like a walking tree trunk than I did a human being. Anyway, being a nice polite English girl, and not knowing anything about Orthodox synagogues with upstairs and downstairs seating. And it's really not very polite to start nosing around upstairs when you go somewhere new for the first time, correct? So I walked in and I sat down. Well, of course, yes, I sat down in the men's section. Great. Well, I hadn't been there more than a couple of seconds before this elderly gentleman came scurrying over to me and he tells me, I'm sorry, but you have to leave. So I figure to myself, good grief, what's wrong with my face? My sister told me nobody bothered her. I've only just sat down, they're already asking me to leave. Well, this gentleman seemed quite adamant that, you know, he's pointing to the door. So I stand up quietly and out I go. He follows me out, and then I looked at him and I said, you honestly mean that I can't stay here? So he gave me this like strange little look, because you have to understand there wasn't anything about me that day that would give an inkling that I was a Jew. And he said, okay, the women go upstairs. Shows me the door to go upstairs, and off I went. Well, I just about passed out when I got up there. It was a huge synagogue, seats all going up, names on every seat. And there must have been 3 women, if. I don't know where all these people went, but of course my sister had gone on Yom Kippur, and this was a regular Shabbos. Of course my name was nowhere to be found. I'd just been kicked out from downstairs, and all I could think was, good grief, there's nowhere to sit down here.
then.
Okay, I take a book from the window ledge and I perch myself on the edge of someone's seat. And we stood up and we sat down. And we stood up and we sat down. And it was all in Hebrew and I didn't know what on earth was going on. I stayed a few moments and I went scurrying off out of there and laughing to myself as I went skipping off up the hill back to the church, and I said to myself, no wonder my mother left. It really is as I was taught my whole life. Ancient tradition, dead religion, bondage. There's nothing there for me. It was all washed up 2,000 years ago, and I'm never going there again. Fine, I continued with my life in the church. It was a 4-year ministerial degree. Because I'd started 2 years earlier, I was already ordained as a minister, and I wasn't even 21 years old. My father was delighted. He was absolutely thrilled. And he was so proud of me. I renewed my vows, and it was a very high time for me in the church. But about 6 months after my ordination, I learned that my Uncle Sammy, my mother's youngest brother, this was the 10th child of my grandparents, the one that my grandfather had prayed for and fasted for, was coming to England on a holiday. I was so excited because I knew that I would never be allowed to go to Israel. So I was finally getting to see one of my mother's relatives and my Jewish uncle in real life. I was thrilled. The principal must have tuned into this excitement, and he called me into his office. He was very strict, more like a Dickensian schoolmaster, someone who just walked out of Charles Dickens. And he spoke to me very sternly, and he tells me, I'm just warning you that your uncle just might offer you a ticket to Israel. You know what to say, don't you? Well, of that I understood he's telling me no. Fine. My uncle arrived. We were going for a walk in the church, in the gardens. And my uncle looked at me and he said, Tony, what are you doing behind these high walls? What are you doing wearing such dark clothes? Don't you know that God gave you life? To be lived, to be enjoyed. Come on, cheer up a little bit. Laugh a little bit. Have fun. He said, you know what? I'll send you a ticket to Israel. Why don't you come? Oh, Uncle, I told him, you don't understand. I gave my life to God. And it's not mine to do with anymore. I tried to make my uncle understand that I'd totally given over my life forever to God. Well, my uncle, being very Jewish, was not going to be put off with any of this. And he sat next to me. He wasn't given really any time with me. And so he opted to sit next to me, even in church. And in the middle of hymns and prayers, he'd knock my arm and say, come on, Tony, I'll send you a ticket. Come. And then we would go for a walk after, and he'll tell me, come, you'll be like a daughter in my house. Auntie Maria will take good care of you. And, you know, you don't worry. My uncle was the one that told me that the Jews will accept you as Jewish. Your mother is Jewish, and you won't have a problem. You will be accepted in Israel. But I'd been so heavily indoctrinated that I was not Jewish, according to God, that my uncle's words did not hold weight. And I told my uncle, thank you very much, uncle, but I'm not going to come to Israel. When my uncle was ready to leave, he said, you know, Tony, I wish that I had your faith to believe in something as strongly as what you believe in what you're doing. He said, don't get me wrong, I don't want to believe in what you believe in, but I wish that I had your strength of faith, strength of commitment, to believe in anything. He said, okay, so you're not going to come to Israel, but ask me for anything. I want you to have something from Israel. Ask me for it. I'll do my best to send it to you. I thought for a moment. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you because I want to get through the story so I could progress a little at the end. During my uncle's stay, He told me all kinds of interesting things about life in Israel. Even though my uncle himself was very proud of the fact that he did not believe in God. And after he told me he didn't believe in God, he then proceeded to tell me about all the miracles that he himself had witnessed in all the wars that he'd gone through. But he also mentioned to me that his eldest daughter, my cousin Naomi, was moving from Kiryat Shmona to Haifa, moving into a new home. And my uncle said, on my way back home, I'm looking forward to seeing Naomi in her new house and putting the mezuzah on the outside of her door, as is the Sephardi custom. So now, when my uncle was about to leave, and he asked me for anything I wanted from Israel, I'd asked him and said to him, what's the mezuzah? And he told me, explained to me exactly what it was. And I was so interested and intrigued by it, I asked my uncle for a mezuzah. Well, about 10 days later, a small package arrives for me. Inside was a beautiful, full-sized kosher mezuzah. And my uncle had put it inside a very beautiful olive wood box. He'd drawn a diagram as to which doorpost, how far up, at what angle, and everything. All the instructions. That night, after evening prayers, I ran down to the cellars. I managed to find a hammer and some nails. I ran back up to my room, which I shared with two non-Jews. And I took my uncle's letter and made sure to do everything just perfectly. And I banged the mezuzah on the door. My uncle had mentioned to me you're supposed to kiss it. So I kissed it. Then all of a sudden I got so scared. I figured, oh, good, what did I do? I forgot to ask permission first. How could I have done such a thing? I'm standing there looking at it and thinking, but it's only a piece of wood, and it's only a piece of parchment. The only thing I could possibly have done wrong is that I didn't ask permission first. I'll take it down quickly. I'll run to the principal's office, and for sure he'll say yes. I was very naive. I still am. Well, I take it down quickly, and I go galloping over to the principal's office. It's about 11 o'clock at night by this time. And knock on the door, you know, I go in. I said, look, my uncle sent me a mezuzah from Israel, and it's so pretty. Could I please put it up? Thank you, Julius. He said, he just held his hand out at first. And I popped it in, and he kept his hand at arm's length. He sort of like screw his nose up and like finger it like as if it was rotten food or something. And he tells me, just look at it, child. I said, I'm looking at it. What's wrong with it? He said, what's wrong with it? Tell me. What's nice about it? So I said, well, actually, what's nice about it is that my uncle sent it to me from Israel. And could I please put it up? He was quiet for a moment and then he said, no, the Jews have this for superstitious reasons, and we don't believe in that kind of rubbish. He said, no, you cannot put it up. But the amazing thing was, he gave it to me back. There was nothing I could do or say. I took it quietly, and I went back to my room. I popped it in my bedside cabinet. I'll tell you the truth. I forgot about it. I don't remember ever once taking that mezuzah out and looking at it. But the amazing thing is, when I look back on my life, whether you want to say it's superstition or not, that little kosher mezuzah remained right by my head, and the years went by. I was totally, totally seeped in a life of idol worship, the very lowest that a Jewish soul could sink. Innocently, I was entrenched in this lifestyle, but nevertheless, I was surrounded and totally given over to it. But this little kosher mezuzah was right by my side. 5 years later, out of the blue, one Saturday morning I was out for a walk, and I happened to be going past the synagogue, and I don't know why, I didn't really previously think about it, but I just popped in. Of course, I knew to go upstairs this time. I knew no one was going to smile at me, and I just popped in and I sat quietly in the back. It so happened that the rabbi was taking the Torah out from the Aron HaKodesh, from the Holy Ark. And he held it and faced the congregation, and he said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And the congregation repeated the words. And I thought, hey, that's really cute. All you have to do is copy what the rabbi says, and you can partake in the service. Of course, I had no idea what these words meant. But I copied along, and I figured, hey, it's just like kindergarten. Well, I sing 3 moments, and I went back to the church. Several months later, I decided to go to the synagogue again. I made sure to get there. The time had gone previously, so I could see again if the rabbi would take the Torah out. And again, I was able to repeat the words. Slowly, slowly, without me really realizing at first what was happening, my Jewish soul was awaking out of its stupor. As the time went by, the more I went to the synagogue, for some reason it awakened a longing in me simply to be with Jews. Now, I told you, I was very popular in the church. I was extremely successful with everything I was doing. And I couldn't understand why I felt drawn to the Jews. They were heathens. They were unbelievers. I was the preacher's daughter and a minister myself. Why did I feel drawn to them? And many times when I would be standing there in the synagogue, I would say to myself, what am I doing here? Take off these rose-colored glasses and look at this for what it really is. This is dead religion and ancient traditions and bondage. What you have in the church is life and freedom. What do you want here? These people don't even want anything to do with you. Why do you keep coming here? And I would tell myself, yes, I'm never coming here again. And I would scurry out of the synagogue quickly and I would run back off to the church. But after several weeks or a couple of months, that ache, that longing, that feeling of isolation to be with a Jew was so intense within me that I just had to go to the synagogue for a few moments. There was obviously a very big transition time going on here. When I was in the church, I felt like something was also amiss in the very gut of my life. I tried many times to speak to those in authority over me. I tried many times to speak to the principal and say to him, when you have a spiritual experience, where do you go from there? He didn't understand what I was saying. What I really was asking, where do I find God? Within the spiritual experience. That was what I wanted. I didn't mind to eat rotten food or fast like I told you. But where was God? I wanted to find God. And I couldn't find him. Oh, I told myself many times, I just pushed it out of my mind, and of course this is the right way, and this is my calling, and I was working on literature, and I would continue with my life very zealously and enthusiastically, and try and squash these thoughts out of my mind. But still I was drawn to the synagogue. My conscience would never allow me to run out of the synagogue if I had to make a contribution in our service. So during morning devotions, I would pray to God and ask, please don't let me be on anything in the weekend services so that I could sneak out of the synagogue with a clear conscience. Then in order to save time, because our service started at 12 o'clock and as a minister I had to be on the platform at 11:45, whereas the synagogue mostly didn't finish until about 12:10 or 12:15. So I always had to go early. In order to save time, I would put my Bibles and hymn books and prayer books and stuff underneath my seat on the platform before I left, so that all I had to do was literally run straight from the synagogue and into the church. Did that many, many times, and no one knew, because it was a very private time, Saturday morning. And many times people would just go off and pray alone. This one Saturday morning, the rabbi stood up to speak. He was very strict with his congregants. He said if they didn't show up, he wasn't going to give a drasha or a sermon. It must have been a bar mitzvah or something special, because there were more people there that week. And the rabbi stood up to speak, and he spoke about Abraham and Isaac. Oh, come on, I've known about Abraham and Isaac in Sunday school since my earliest years. I thought I knew everything by heart that the Bible had to say about it. And yet the rabbi was bringing in all kinds of interesting things that I'd never heard of before. Obviously he was bringing in from Rashi, from the Mefarshim, the commentaries, and from the Midrash. I got so engrossed with what he was saying, I forgot about the time. When I looked at my watch, it was 11:55. I was already late. It was pouring with rain that day. I had to go up a steep hill. The wind was blowing against me. By the time I got to the back porch in the church, it was so obvious that I hadn't come from my room to the church. My face was beetroot red. I was dripping with perspiration. And so everyone was sitting quietly on their seats, and I decided, you know what? I'll wait till they sing the first hymn, and everyone will stand up. And then I could sneak in down the side, and maybe nobody will notice that I wasn't there. And I waited and waited, and it gets later and later, and they didn't start. Finally, it was getting so late, I figured I'd better get in there. To cut a long story short, the principal called me into his office afterwards, and he asked me where I was. I was afraid to lie, because I was told if I told a lie, I would burn in hell forever. It's a very sinful, soulful lie. So I said, well, I was just out for a walk, and I happened to be going past the synagogue, and I decided to pop in and see what a synagogue was like inside. He said, you what? He said, I'm telling you, child, you are a Gentile. The Bible says you are a Gentile. God says you are a Gentile. And you have to tell yourself every morning when you get up, you tell yourself three times, I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile. The very last thing on your mind before you go to bed at night will be, I am a Gentile. He's literally screaming at me. He banned me from ever having any contact with Jews and from ever going to the synagogue again. I'll tell you the truth, I was quite relieved. I thought, this is what's wrong with me. I have to tell myself every morning and every night that I'm a Gentile, and then these Jewish feelings and this Jewish business, wherever it's coming from, is going to stop haunting my life, and I'm going to be able to continue as a good Christian minister with a clear conscience. And I figured, what a good idea. So with all the strength I could muster within myself, day and night, I tell myself, I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile. Or maybe I could just sneak in a little joke here. Do you like jokes? Can't get too serious, right? Well, there's two main Christian groups, Protestants and Catholics. Each one says the other one's going to burn in hell forever. So there was once a Protestant, and he decided he wanted to convert to Catholic religion. He goes to the priest, and the father's delighted, and he puts his hands on his head, and he sprinkles him with some holy water, and he says to him three times, you're a Catholic, you're a Catholic, you're a Catholic. And he tells him, well, now that you're a Catholic, one of the things that you must not do is eat meat on a Friday. Oh, sure, Father, he says, no problem, I could handle that. So he goes on his way. A couple of weeks go by, and the priest decides to visit his new convert. It happens to be Friday. He knocks on the door, and whilst he's waiting for him to come, he sniffs in the air, and he thinks, good grief, it smells like chicken coming from his house. Well, anyway, when he opens the door, the convert opens the door, and he says to the priest, oh, Father, come inside, how nice to see you. Well, the priest is so upset, he gets to the point right away, and he says, don't you remember that I told you that now you're a Catholic, you're not to eat meat on a Friday? What's going on here? said, look, please, Father, don't get so upset. I don't have a chicken or any meat cooking in my oven. It's a fish. The priest was so put out. He said, please, open the oven door right now. I have to see for myself to see what's inside. When he opens the oven door and the priest peeps inside, what does he see but this golden brown chicken sizzling away there? The convert said, please, Father, don't worry. Before I put it in the oven, I sprinkled it with some water, and I put my hands on it 3 times, and I said, you're a fish, you're a fish, you're a fish. No, kid, don't. I actually heard it from a preacher that came to our school assembly when I was about 13 years old. But when I was thinking about it, I thought how beautifully it illustrated my own predicament at that time. There I was, in a Christian theological college, with a Jewish soul. I had no idea about a Jewish soul. I'd never even heard of such a thing. And I'm telling myself, every morning and every night, with all the strength and sincerity I could muster within myself, I am a Gentile. I am a Gentile. I am a Gentile. That went on for months. And one morning I sit bolt upright in bed and I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile, I'm a Gentile. And I said to myself, wait a minute. Do we have to make such a big deal about all of this? Who cares what I am anyway? And just say for some bizarre reason, maybe I'm a Jew. So what? Why can't I just be a Jew and be a good Christian minister? What's the contradiction here? I had a lot to learn, as you could see. Anyway, I decided whatever I am, that's it. I'm not going to say it anymore, and who cares anyway? It was only a few months after that. I had to preach the main sermon. And I don't know why I remember this one time of others, but I remember that I was taking my Bibles and study books down from the shelves. And I felt like I'd grasped everything there was to grasp with Jesus. There we were, like on the Jericho Road, just room for just two, right? Arm in arm, pally-pally down the road. And yet, I didn't feel so close. I felt kind of close in my mind, you know, as close as I made it. But instead of feeling fulfilled, instead of feeling satiated and close to God, I still felt totally distant and alone. And I said to myself that day, is there really a God? Or have I just been brainwashed all of my life? How could I feel that I understand everything there is to understand about God and not feel satiated? How could I feel that I've exhausted everything there is to know about Christianity and not feel close to God? Is it maybe I've just been so heavily indoctrinated about hellfire and eternal damnation that I'm afraid not to believe all of this? You know, deep in the heart of every Jew is a faith in God that will never die. I said to myself that day, there has to be a God. And if there is a God, it is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham's God is the one and only true God. From then on, without telling a soul, when I lay down on that church floor in meditation, or knelt for hours on end, I no longer prayed to Jesus, Yeshua HaMashiach, whatever you want to call him. I prayed to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I said exactly this. If only you could hear me now, please hear me and lead me to all truth, whatever it might be. said to myself, have you gone mad? What are you asking from God now? Wasn't I taught my whole life that this was the way of truth? This was the way of light and life? Had I not left the way of the world, the vanities of life, of materialism? All of this I had left 8.5 years before, and secluded myself behind these high walls, and totally dedicated my life to God. What was I asking? But something in the very gut of my being would not rest, and day after day and week after week, I prayed sincerely from the very depths of myself to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Never in 1,000,000 years did I think that that prayer would be heard or God would lead me to the place where I am today. It so happened Passover 13 years ago, many of you will remember, Erev Passover was on Shabbat. The halachas, the laws pertaining to that particular year, as of this year that just passed us, were quite different to every year. Rabbi Menachem Schneerson of Lubavitch suggested that Jewish leaders throughout the world should print a leaflet explaining the laws of Passover, that people would not innocently come to make a mistake. Of course, Lubavitch in London, Chabad, printed a leaflet and distributed it. It so happened that we were having an international convention in the church. Our particular group believed in New Covenant Israel, and so they kept somewhat, by this time, some of the Jewish holidays. A group of Christians associated with our church, not Jewish, any of them at all, had gone to Chabad in Oslo. They were coming in from Norway in an effort to convert them. Good choice, right? So they, Shalom Aleichem, they say, we are Jews and we are going to England to keep the Passover. Well, they gave them the address of head office of Lubavitch in London. They went out of their way. They picked up some of these leaflets and they brought them back to the church. It so happened I was not able to get a leaflet because I'd been banned from having all contact with Jews, but obviously I desperately wanted one. To cut a long story short, I managed to get my hands on one by the end of the week. I hid it in my room, and that night when my roommates were asleep, I took it out and read it. I was actually quite disappointed. It opened out into 6 tiny sides, back and front, a tiny print. And it was talking about all kinds of things to do with Passover that I had absolutely no understanding about. Like an afikomen and the poem about a goat and a declaration to sell your chametz to a rabbi and you write in his name and all kinds of laws. But I was working full-time on the literature in the church, and I decided to write to the address in the bottom. I wrote a very simple letter. All I said was, all I know is my mother is a Jew. I do not know if I'm a Jew or I'm not. I've had no Jewish education whatsoever. But I came across this leaflet on Passover, and did they have any more on any of the other Jewish holidays? I sent it off. Of course, my return address was a Christian theological college. And I waited. Believe me, there's many, 1,000 things I have to miss out tonight, because you'll be here till tomorrow morning. You probably wouldn't complain, but I have to catch a plane. Anyway, but a lot of things happened during this time as to when I posted that letter off and to when I received a reply. But I thank God to this day that my reply came in a plain brown envelope. No Jewish stars, no menorah, no Hebrew letters. Had there been, I never would have got that letter. Not only that, but it was postmarked from the city of Birmingham, and we happened to have a congregation in the city of Birmingham, and I got the letter unopened. When I took it to my room, I was quite surprised to see that it was from a rabbi. He was telling me that he was going to be in Nottingham on such and such a day, and that if I could suggest a venue, he would be most happy to discuss Judaism with me for 20 minutes. I just about dropped dead. I was so scared. I figured, heck, I didn't want to see a rabbi. I just wanted a leaflet. And how could I discuss something that I know absolutely nothing about? And I was like chuckling to myself and thinking, God, what did I get myself into now? Well, after a time, I decided that 20 minutes wasn't such a large amount of time, and I was always sent on errands in the church anyway. I could just say that I got stuck in traffic. No, not such a bad lie. And I decided to try my odds at calling up the rabbi. Locked myself into one of the offices, and I tell him, please do not call me, do not write to me, do not have anything to do with me whatsoever. I've been banned from having all contact with Jews. But any time I could secretly get into an office and call you, I'll try to do it. He said, fine. Well, we did not get to see each other the first day because we missed each other, and I was taken to the Birmingham congregation when he was in the city of Nottingham. Managed to get in touch with him again, and he said he has an uncle who's a podiatrist. He lives on the other side of the city, and he's agreed that we could meet in his house. That was a very long drive to his uncle's house, and I said it would be quite difficult, but I would do my best. It was all arranged for a Tuesday evening. Prior to that, on the Monday, I had to take designs to the principal in his office to get checked before they would go to press. He didn't even look at them, put them on one side, and he kept me there in his office for 3.5 hours, questioning me. Finally, I said, okay, I'll tell you. I contacted a rabbi, and I'm going to see him tomorrow. And even if you tell me I'm not, I am. He said, you what? He said, he thumped his hand down. He said, did you pray about this child? I said, pray about it? What was there to pray about? For 25 years you've told me this is the right way. Believe it, preach it, live it. That's exactly what I've been doing. And you've never given me a chance to find out for myself. And anyway, if you're so sure that this is the right way, what are you so worried about? So I'll go and ask a rabbi some silly questions, and I'll come back. Actually, this is where I got the title of my book. It's called Playing with Fire. He started to scream at me. I mean, scream. I'm telling you, child, you are playing with fire. Leave it alone. He kept saying, do you hear me? Leave it alone. I said, look, I'm not asking for any thunderbolts from heaven. I'm not asking to see Jesus in flesh and blood in front of me. I'm not asking to see great miracles. All I'm asking is for a quiet confidence in the very gut of my life, that what I've dedicated my life to is a reality. Why do I have to tell myself every morning when I get up, this is the right way, believe it? If Jesus is really God, and he's really come into my life, then why doesn't he just stand up and be God? Why does his very existence in my life depend on my belief? Is this God? If God is God, then please, God, stand up and be God, whether I believe in him or not. I just seen a poster. An August poster, I'd happened to see it a couple of days before this was occurring. I'm sure many of you know it. There was a young colt, there's a colt running free in the field. And the caption on the bottom is, if you love something, let it go free. And if it returns to you, it's yours for eternity. And if it doesn't, it was never meant to be. I told this to the principal. He was so angry. He was literally shaking from head to foot. But to this day, I can't believe what he said. He went to the door of his office to leave. And then he turned around and he looked at me. And he said, "Do you know, there is something the matter with your soul, child. And I just can't put my finger on what it is." Well, I had no idea I had a Jewish soul, like I said, and that was what was wrong with my soul. So I leave quietly and I go back to my office and to the drawing board and I continued with my work. Every 15, 20 minutes, he's walking up the stairs, stump, stump, stump to my office, stands right by the drawing board. "Did you make up your mind yet, child?" I said, "No, I didn't make up my mind. I'm telling you, you're playing with fire." Stump, 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 he's gone. Then 15, 20 minutes, he's there again. This went on for about 5 hours. You can imagine at the end of that time, I tell you the truth, I was a total basket case. I get back to the main headquarters. I lock myself into one of the offices and I'm a mess, a mess. So I call up the rabbi and I said, "I think I want to leave it." I was supposed to see him the next night. He said, "No, no, we'll make it another day if it's hard for you." I said, "Look, I'll tell you the truth. I told the principal that I was going to see you, and he's screaming at me the whole afternoon that I'm playing with fire." The rabbi tells me, "Don't worry, trust me. Christianity is the fire." So there I am, this little ping pong ball. So I said, "Look, rabbi, I want you to understand one thing. Nobody is going to ram anything down me anymore. I'm going to go my own way, my own time." He said, "Fine. You have my number. Anytime if you would like to call me, that's fine. If not, you know, whatever, it's up to you." And he put down the phone. About 2 weeks later, I'd fully recovered and I was ready to call the rabbi. Called him up again and we made another time and he tells me, "And don't tell anybody this time." Well, it was actually very hilarious, but I'm not going to give it away. It was very funny how I managed to find him. But anyway, we got together. And he says, "Tell me about yourself." It took about half a second. And then he said, "Well, you know what? I think you owe it to yourself to spend 2 weeks with an Orthodox Jewish family, either in Manchester or in London, and I'm sure I could arrange it for you. After all, come on, you don't know anything about Judaism whatsoever. You've never experienced a Shabbat. You don't know anything about the Jewish traditions or holidays. Don't you think that you should give yourself the opportunity?" I looked at him like a drop from the moon. 2 weeks! Don't you know how hard it was for me to get a half an hour to talk to you without anyone knowing, and now all of a sudden you're talking about 2 weeks? He said, "Well, don't you have any holiday?" I said, "Oh no, we don't have any holiday." I said, "And anyway, I have to give an account of every moment of my day." He said, "That's it. Maybe you could have a mad moment. You know, like just disappear." And he's so excited about it. And I said, "You know, Rabbi, thank you very much, but you know, like, I really don't have mad moments." He kept saying to me, "Think about it." I said, "You know, I'm thinking about it. Well, what do you think? I could just go to what? Jews? Orthodox Jews? For 2 weeks? And then what? Come back and say, 'Well, here I am. I came back now and I tried that and I came back to be a good Christian minister.'" I said, "What do you think? They're going to welcome me with open arms?" I said, "You know, it's going to take me a heck of a lot to repent for that one." He said, "Don't worry. Trust me. I promise I won't leave you in the street. If this church won't take you back, I'll find another one for you." I said, "Thank you very much, Rabbi. You know, it was really very nice of you to give me this time, but God, it seemed like so much. How could I throw away 25 years of my life? For what? This whisper, this feeling in the very gut of my life? And it bothered me so much. Why couldn't I get rid of this Jewish feeling, this Jewish business that had come to haunt my life so? Why couldn't I just forget about it?" But I couldn't. And it bothered me. But I said to myself, I said, thank you very much to the rabbi, and goodbye. But I stood there, rooted on the sidewalk, on the pavement, and I watched him disappear into the distance. And as his car drove away, it was like in the very depths of myself, I was screaming after him, wait, don't leave me here. I found you already, and you've gone. I said to myself, how could I feel that I could just go with this rabbi? I haven't even met him for half an hour. And then I could just take off and forget about my whole life. I said, no, this is not me. And I went back to the church. There was also many things that happened. But to cut a long story short, another 2 weeks later, I was supposed to be preaching the main sermon of the weekend. And I just knew that I couldn't do it. I just lost total confidence in my wares. And I said to myself, if I'm going to leave, it has to be now. It was about 5 o'clock on Saturday morning. My two roommates were asleep. I had no money except by divine providence. One of my aunts had seen me a week before and she'd given me £5. Not a very lot of money. I don't know how much it is in Canadian dollars, but not much. I had one cheese sandwich for my breakfast. My family, my friends, every single person on earth I knew was a strict Christian. The rabbi, I didn't even know if he would want anything to do with me. I mean, it was one thing making a suggestion, but it was another thing just dumping myself on him. And anyway, it was Saturday. That much I knew, that he wasn't going to pick up his telephone and answer it. The only place I could think to hide, because it was pouring with rain, was where we did the printing. There was a big factory, and in the top was a small attic room that no one went in because it was the mice's haven. So it was like not a very nice place, but I figured at least I would be safe and dry. So I hide up there. And when Shabbat finishes and it gets to the evening, I figure it's not very polite. I'll wait till the next morning. So I call the rabbi early. Of course, he's not there. He's in the synagogue. So I said to his wife, look, if he comes back by 9 o'clock, ask him to call me. Well, he called me up like 5 to 9. And he said, where are you? What have you done? I said, well, I ran away. He said, good for you, where are you? I'll come and pick you up. I said, no, you have to understand. I have to get out of here now. I said, I was hoping to get in touch with you earlier. I said, I've just got to get away because they're going to take me back. So I said, I have this money for a bus to Birmingham. He said, fine, just come. I said, but Rabbi, you don't understand. I don't have anything. He said, what do you mean you don't have anything? I said, look, just the clothes I'm standing in. He said, don't worry, my wife will take care of everything. Just come. Then he said, give me 5 minutes, I'll call you back. He calls me right back and he tells me, you know, there's a really nice family in Hampstead Garden suburbs. It's near Golders Green. And they have 7 children. And they've agreed to take you for their au pair. They're waiting for an au pair to come in from Europe later on in the week. But they have this room available for a few days. How about it? I said, well, what's an au pair? You know, he said, it's someone that takes care of children like a nanny. What he didn't tell me was the eldest of these 7 children was 8. I said, I think I've taught children in the Sunday school. I'm sure I could handle it. I take a bus to Birmingham. True to his word, he picks me up. His wife very nicely presents me with a carry bag full of lovely clothes. God bless her, she'd never met me before. She'd never seen me. We were about 2 sizes apart. But they gave me the clothes. And they took me down to London to this family. This very nice lady welcomes me into her home. Her husband is right behind her. And I try to shake his hand. And he said, I'm sorry, but we don't shake hands. And I figured, good grief, he doesn't want to shake my hand because I'm a Gentile. Because I didn't know what I was. when I left the church, I had only one thing clear in my mind. For some reason, Christianity was not right for me. It could be right for everyone in the church, but it wasn't right for me. I had no idea why. And I wanted to find God. And I said to myself, whatever the price, if I have to sleep in the gutter, if I have to do any kind of menial task, I am going to do it in order to find the one and only true God. When I entered into this Jewish home, they really didn't look like any of the Jews that I'd seen in the synagogue in Nottingham, and I felt like I'd landed on the moon without learning to be an astronaut. They showed me to my room, and one by one the children came up. They introduced themselves. The first one, my name is Hannah Fega. The second one, my name is Rivka Chenya. Third one, my name is Shmar Yahu. I was just about dropping dead by this time. And I figured, my God, I said I would take care of these kids. I can't even say their names. Where did they get these names from? Well, after they'd run out of children to send up, I think it's not very polite. So I washed myself up, and I put on the Rebbetzin's clothes, and I kept on my headscarf, and I had these clumpy nunnish shoes, and I went downstairs. Those children, I love them so much. I'm so close to this family to this day. You know, not one of them laughed. They were so sweet to me. And I stayed a little bit, and I scurried off back to my room. The next day, I tried again. Do you know, one of the interesting things was, one day, I was in a position of authority in the church. And the next day, when I entered into their home, I couldn't even speak. My very mannerisms, the words I used, were so totally wrong that you could almost feel the walls of the house like cringe every time I opened my mouth. And I spoke about the Heavenly Father and the Holy Spirit and the Messiah and the Holy Bible. And it was like everyone was very sweet. And the next day, when I was downstairs, I still had on my headscarf. They tell me, don't worry, God will not be angry with you. You could take off the headscarf. So I took off the headscarf. Then they tell me, strict Protestant women never cut their hair. So my hair was tied and twisted around in a tight neck bun. They looked at me and said, not a very Jewish hairstyle. Why don't you let your hair down? So I let my hair down. Well, my hair was almost to my knees. Now I had to pull it aside before I sat down because it would yank my head back. So now I have this hair and these clothes and these shoes, right? And I'm just praying to God with my whole heart, dear God, just let them know that I'm normal. And that I haven't made up this bizarre story and bursted in through their doors and totally lost my brains. As the week progressed, I was getting brave enough to ask one or two questions. When it came to the Friday, I'd arrived in their home on Sunday afternoon. This nice Jewish mama, she explained to me that on a Friday night, it's the custom that Jewish girls and women light a candle. She said, no problem. It's no, rush for you to push yourself into doing it. We understand it's all very new and strange to you, but I'll put a candle out. If you would like to light it, that's fine, and if not, we fully understand. Well, middle of the day, the telephone rings. It's the rabbi. What is he telling me? That the principal of the college managed to contact him. How did he manage to find him? You won't believe it, but he had corns on his feet. And who should be his podiatrist? Rabbi Arbish's uncle. Well, kind of long story short, he tells me, no, we really, you know, I've known her since her earliest years. I'm like an uncle to her. You know, I understand she's going through a very hard time. And I want you to know that we're holding her position in the church for 2 weeks. And if she would like to come back, she can take up her position as a minister and everything will be forgiven. The rabbi said, I think she would like a little more time to think things over. And he said to me, was that okay? I said, fine, thank you. And I put the phone down. Well, then I got so scared. And all of a sudden I figured, my God, this is it. For the first time in my life, I've had one. This is a mad moment. What ever possessed me to do such a thing? I've blown 25 years of my life. I've thrown it away for what? I said, that's it. I'm not going to light this candle. I'll just stay in my room. I'll have to tell the children I don't feel well. Don't ask me why I didn't just take off at that moment. But I decided I would stay in my room for Shabbat. And when it finished, then I would hitch a ride and thumb a lift back to Nottingham. And even if I clean church floors for the rest of my life, at least my soul would be saved. Then after I'm sitting up there in my room, tell myself, you know what? This is it. This is the perfect opportunity you've been needing all of these years. You can experience what Judaism has to offer firsthand. You can prove to yourself once and for all that there's absolutely nothing in it. And at least when you go back to the church, it will be with a clear conscience. I figured, what a great idea. That's it. So with that in mind, I came back downstairs. This nice lady tells me, would you like to take a shower and wash your hair? His hair was like, already the whole community was talking about it. So I said, you know, I really don't mind to help you more. Well, she must have asked me at least a half a dozen times, don't worry, the bathroom is empty, there's plenty of hot water, you know, it's okay, please take a shower now. So I tell her, I really don't mind to help you. I felt kind of obligated. And in my mind, I was thinking when Shabbos comes in, oh, take a nice hot bath, bubbles, dreaming. I was dreaming of everything, but I didn't say what I was thinking, and she thought I understood. Well, it came a couple of hours or so later. She makes an announcement. Okay, children, time to light candles. Well, these little kids start scurrying from like every direction in this huge home. And they're all arguing among themselves, who's going to say the blessing for me to repeat after them? Five of them are little girls. Well, I was like so disgruntled, I said to myself, I don't think much of this. This is an Orthodox home, a religious home. Well, isn't this supposed to be the holy Sabbath? Aren't we going to do something holy now? Oh, well, if we're going to do something holy in the church... Oh, so we lie down on the floor, maybe kneel down quietly, quiet meditation, soft music, you know, like get into the presence of things. Nope, the house is hectic and busy, time to light candles. So I trundle into the dining room, they tell me to wave my hands 3 times over the flame, I'm so embarrassed, go like this. Then they tell me to repeat these words, I mumble bumble my way through. Good Shabbos, they tell me. I said, well, good Shabbos. Is it okay if I take a shower and wash my hair now? She said, I'm sorry, but I thought you understood. We don't do that. I said, what do you mean you don't do that? She said, I mean on Shabbos. We don't take a shower and wash our hair. That's why I asked you so many times before. Oh, God, I was so mad. All I could think was my dad telling me when I was growing up, always remember wherever you go, it's the first impression that counts. I'm thinking, they're going to want me to go to the synagogue looking like this tomorrow? It's not my fault. They should have explained it better. Believe me, I look like something the cat had dragged in, even worse. So I figured it's not my fault. I was so frustrated. I went stomping up the stairs, 2 big flights of stairs to my room. And I was so angry that I said to myself, I am still going to take a shower and wash my hair. It's not my fault. When I stomped up the door and I was just about to barge into my room, I want you to know it was pure mercy from God, that he revealed himself to me in a way that I totally did not deserve, but in the only way I could understand. There was such a peace in that room that I literally jumped back, and all I could say was, "My God, God is here. You did not have to tell me that the one and only true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was here in this home with these people. How could it be?" I turned around, and as I was standing there on the landing, I realized that the whole house was filled with this peace. But these were Orthodox Jews. This was supposed to be dead religion and ancient traditions and bondage. How could it be that they had felt God in this way, in a way more real than I had ever felt him in 25 years of my life? What had they done? I said, "My God, I only lit a candle. Nobody made this presence. 1 minute the house was hectic, and we lit a candle, and Shabbos came." Oh, I didn't want to take a shower and wash my hair anymore. Never in my life had I felt God like that. No, I didn't want him to leave. I didn't want to do anything that would disturb that peace and make it go away. Neither did I want to go back to the church. Oh, I had to find out. What did I have to do to find God in this way? The amazing thing was, for the first time in my life, I did one simple act that God said to do. God said, "Jewish women, light a candle on Friday nights." He said, "Keep kosher." He said, "Put on tefillin." He never said, "Eat rotten food or fast for days on end and we'll find him." He said simply, "Do my mitzvah." This is our eternal connection to God, to everything that ever was, and everything that ever will be. You know, everything I searched for in Christianity, everything I yearned for, I have found in a million times more with living an observant lifestyle. I don't think it was easy. Believe me, when I arrived in their home, it was 1 week before Rosh Hashanah, the last week of the month of Elul. I just got used to the braided challahs. They disappeared and the round one showed up. They took me on the first day of Rosh Hashanah to shake out my pockets so that my sins could go to the fish. And I figured, hey, you know what? The Jews have got real original ideas of how to get rid of sins. Then I don't know if any of you are aware of what the Hasidim do with the chickens on Kapparos, right? Anyway, to cut a long story short, the chickens came. They were housed in the garage. They tried many times to explain to me what was going to happen. For the life of me, I couldn't trust myself that what I was really hearing was actually what was going to happen. Anyway, sure enough, Erev Yom Kippur, this nice, lovely, petite English lady stands on a chair in her back garden and takes this live bird and starts swinging it over her head. And she tells me, "Would you like to stand underneath?" I said, "No, thanks. What do you want to stand under a live swinging bird for? Don't you know what they do?" I said, "Well, you know what? The Jews believe in good luck." "Okay, fine." I said, "You know what? I'll watch from upstairs." I was so glad to see those chickens go. I never did ask what happened to them. Well, then the father of the home comes in. We have this elaborate meal, and then he dresses in this 18th century looking nightshirt in his like white kissel, and he puts on his bedroom slippers and he takes a candle to surely looks like Wee Willie Winkie in his nightshirt. And they tell me I have to put on my bedroom slippers and walk through the streets of London in bedroom slippers. I was bright red. We had to cross like six lanes of traffic, and I was like, my head was down, I was crying, you know. You could just see the amused faces on the driver's face, you know, like as this unannounced carnival goes by. Anyway, finally we get to the shore, and fasting was no big deal, and anyway, it was only one day. So then the gentleman, the father of the home, comes back after Yom Kippur. He's just fasted, no food, no drink for 26 hours. And he comes diving straight through the house and again into the garage. And I figured, oh my God, what now? He comes staggering out with these heavy boards and a hammer and nails, and he tells me he has to build this sukkah. It looks like a garden shed. I mean, does this guy really have to build a garden shed when he's just fasting for the whole day? And he said, look, Toby, you see, like, the Jews are always running from one mitzvah to the other. We just finished with Yom Kippur, and now we're up to sukkahs. Fine, gets his nails in. Then comes to sukkahs, we're shivering to death. It's end of October. You know, like, who sits outside and eats outside, you know, like picnics in October? So they give me one cardigan and another cardigan, and they say, are you having a lovely time? Yes, we are. Thank you so much. All right, then it comes to Simchas Torah, and I came from a home, no smoking, no drinking, no nothing, right? I have never in my life seen anything. This lovely family have this big home, and they have a custom of making a party for the whole synagogue in their home every Simchat Torah. So I just kept like peeping through the door, and stuff was getting spilled everywhere, and they were a very lively time, and I couldn't understand why this nice lady was not bothered about her carpet. Didn't she care that everything was being spilled all over it? But no, it was Simchat Torah. Well, when we got it all cleaned up, it must have been about 3:30 in the morning, and the Zaidi, the grandfather of the home, and I was sitting exhausted on the couch, and he comes to me and he tells me, how was it? I said, fine, thank you. He said, you know, you're a very lucky girl. And I said, yes, thank you. You know, when I look back on my life, at that time in my life, I must tell you the truth, lucky was not on my list. Totally bewildered, yes, but lucky, I didn't feel it. But now when I look back, I'll tell you, I can't believe it. Every day is like a chair. I can't tell you how, never mind about freedom, I've never felt so free in my life. To be able to keep Shabbat, to be able to eat kosher, to be able to live as a Jew is total and absolute freedom for the Jewish soul. I want to clarify one thing. It's not my purpose to tell you that Jews are good and non-Jews are bad. What I want you to understand is that a Jew and a non-Jew are different. I don't know why. I guess because I thought about it so much and struggled with the issue in my life, I often wondered, wouldn't it just have been easier for God to make everybody Jewish or everybody not Jewish? What do we need all of this for? Thousands of years of bloodshed and persecution. Do we need this? God, in his divine wisdom, wants a Jew on earth, and he wants and needs a non-Jew too. When will we have ultimate peace on earth? When will we see God on earth? When every one of God's creations is true to who he is. It's for the Jew to live as a Jew, and for the non-Jew to serve God in a non-Jewish way. Do you know that Judaism is the only one of the major religions in the world that offers eternal life to people outside of its religion. The Christians say, you believe in Jesus or you're damned. You can burn in hell. You can burn real bad. The Muslims say, believe their way, Islam, but not Torah. There are 7 commandments for the non-Jew. There is a place in Torah for the righteous Gentile. This is what God wants from him. I want to close by 2 things. First, I want to tell you a very quick and short story about my mother. And then I want to just make a few intellectual points. Because I've told you really emotionally from my transition. But I just want to bring out 1 or 2 other things. But first I want to tell you about my mother. When I was 18, when I was 2 years in the college, my mother was found to have cancer. She was rushed into hospital. 8 doctors worked on her. She even had a heart attack during the operation. They told my father the next morning, don't thank us. In their own words, they said, it's a miracle that your wife has survived. There were so many things went wrong, so many complications, medically speaking, she should not have pulled through. Well, everyone figured Jesus made a miracle. I was 2 years in the college. My mother, the only thing I could think was that my mother asked to be called Sarah after the operation. She asked to be called of her Jewish name, Sarah. So she was known in the church as Sister Sarah. 7 years later, I left the college. My mother fully recovered, never had a relapse. 2 years later, I've stayed 9 months with this family in London. Then I knew that I wanted to build a Jewish home, and I wanted to do it properly. So I decided to go to yeshiva in Israel to learn full time. Whilst I was there, after I'd been there about 9 months or so, my parents got wind of where I was, and they came over to visit me. My father was sitting in the courtyard with my mother. They both were there, and my father had his Bible. And he's pointing out all the verses, and he's saying, come on, you know this verse by heart, you know that verse by heart, you know chapters of the Bible by heart. How could you do this? After everything that we raised you with, how could you do this? Tells me, come home. We'll nurture you back to sanity. We'll take care of you. He tells me, you know, like, he didn't say, like, exactly nurture you back to sanity. We said, you will nurture you back to health. It was as if, like, he was treating me as if I'd had a mental breakdown. He said, if you really want to get married, I'll find a nice Christian boy for you. He held me with both of my arms. And he looked at me and he was sobbing hysterically. Never seen my father cry like that. And he tells me, promise me right now, promise me you will never marry a Jew. I tell him, Daddy, please don't worry. When it comes to the end of my life, I alone will have to stand before God and answer for my life. I cannot say I live this way because my father lived this way. I must be true to my own inner convictions. I said, Daddy, don't worry. My parents left, they were both crying. Well, several months later, I met my husband. We decided to get married. Now, my husband was learning full-time in the boys' yeshiva. He was actually learning to be a rabbi. Now I figured, now what? Shall I write to my parents and tell them that I'm getting married? Not just to a Jew, but to an Orthodox Jew who's going to be a rabbi. Now I figured, well, you know what? My father's going to come to the wedding and he's going to cry. So I figured, you know what? At least on my wedding day, let me have people around me that are happy with my decision. So I won't tell them. And not only that, but unfortunately, my elder sister, even though she was only 32 years old, had just passed away from cancer. So I figured my parents are going to think that 2 people have died in such a short amount of time. So I said to myself, you know what, I'm not going to tell them.
And somewhere along the line I'll break the news to them. Well, I got married, and then the months went by, and then I got pregnant, and then I was 6 months pregnant, and then I figured, better tell my parents I got married, right? So I wrote a postcard home, and I said that the weather was fine, and I was having a nice time, and P.S., by the way, I got married. My dad, thank God, has a sense of humor, and he wrote that the weather was quite nice in England, too. And P.S., congratulations. My sister told me he was so furious. He was so angry. Anyway, at the first opportunity my father could get away from the church, my parents came over to see who I'd married. My husband was sitting with my father in our small apartment in the living room in Sfat. And my mother came to me in the kitchen, and she whispered to me, and she said, Tova, do you know what prayer I said when I was on the operating table? This was 9 years after my mother's operation. This is the preacher's wife. She sits in church almost every night of the week. She's baptized into the church. She has never spoken one word to me ever about what it means to be a Jew. And I looked at my mother, and I said, Mommy, I don't know what prayer you said. You could have said one of, I don't know, how many prayers? And you guessed. My mother said, Shema. When it came down to an issue of life and death, and my mother was lying there on that operating table, she knew who she was. And not only that, but she knew who was her God. She did not waste one breath on any Anki Panki Pie in the Sky God. She put her trust in the one and only true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And she said, Shema. She never told a soul. It was heresy, almost, for her to admit that. You know, when I saw her just recently, she whispered to me, and she told me, I still pray to Hashem. I sent my mother a mezuzah several years ago for her birthday, and my father allowed her to have it up in the home. And she tells me, and I have the mezuzah. I think my mother's story speaks even louder than my own of the power of the Jewish soul. It doesn't matter how far we go. It doesn't matter what we try and make ourselves into. It doesn't matter what we try to change ourselves into. There is a soul, an eternal soul, in the life of every Jew, and it will never be extinguished. And it connects us eternally to the one and only true God. And I don't care how many Jews want to say that they have found fulfillment in serving Jesus or Yeshua HaMashiach. I know that they will never find total fulfillment. They will never find total satisfaction in their life unless they return. And I want to just point out the Christians, if I may say so kindly, but nevertheless, I speak from my heart. They have made a smear campaign against God. They have made God to be the vengeful God of the Old Testament, who will die and kill anyone who sins. This is not God's way. What did God say after the flood? after Noah, God said, I see the man is sinful from his youth. Therefore, I will not flood the earth again. When my father came to see me, and he was talking to me in the yeshiva, what did he remind me was the Christian message? It was coming up to Passover time. And he tells me, what is the message of Passover? And I didn't say anything because I didn't want to get into arguments with my father. He said, it is the blood. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. You know, in the book of Leviticus, it establishes blood being reserved for atonement. But I want to point out that it does not limit atonement to blood alone. There are many times where the Jewish people have been saved from sin, and no blood sacrifices were ever made. After the sin of the golden calf, God was so angry, he wanted to wipe everyone out. And how were the Jewish people saved? How were we saved? Moses prayed on behalf of the nation, and we were saved. No sacrifices, no blood. The city of Nineveh, with the story of Jonah. Wasn't any sacrifices that the whole city was saved. They were saved by changed actions. That's how they were saved. Let us not forget that Christianity talks about a human sacrifice. There was two Jehovah's Witnesses came to our home. And they're speaking to my husband. My husband said, do you believe that Jesus was the Son of God? Yes, we do, they said. Do you believe that he came down in flesh and blood to walk on earth as a man? Yes, we do, they said. My husband said, do you believe that he was sacrificed for sin? Yes, we do, they said. My husband said, then you believe in human sacrifice, don't you? They faltered for 1 second. Two elderly, nice ladies. And they looked at my husband and said, human sin demands human blood. Is that God? Is it? You know, everyone's heard of Baal, whatever you want to call him. Some people call him Baal, some people call him Baal. The bad guy in the Bible. He was the guy that King Ahab served. Do you know that he was the son of the god El? Do you know that he was sacrificed and rose again in the springtime? Do you know that his disciples called him Lord? Elijah the prophet tried to get King Ahab to turn away from his erroneous ways. Elijah the prophet remained steadfast to the covenant of our forefathers. What happened to both of these two men in the Bible? Ahab was eaten by dogs, and Eliyahu, who lived an observant Jewish lifestyle, was taken into heaven and never died. If man is sinful, how come that Eliyahu, even though he never accepted Baal or any substitute god, was taken without dying to God? And the Christians make a little mistake, because God talks very clearly of who his son is. And he says in the book of Exodus, "And you shall say to Paro, thus says Hashem, my son, my firstborn is Israel." The Jewish people are God's son. And if I may say so, this, I believe, is the root and the source of anti-Semitism. Because while ever we say that we are the rightful heir to God's throne, the Christians know that they have no rightful passage to claim it. Many of the Christians, especially the Messianics, want to say that God made a new covenant. What was the new covenant? They say that the new covenant is in effect now. The new covenant is that God will write his laws on the inward parts of man. He will write the Torah upon their heart. And all men will know God from the least until the greatest. Ask anyone, any Messianic Jew, any Jew for Jesus, anyone. Ask him a question of halacha or Torah. Like, what would happen if this one, this ox gores another one's ox? Do you know the answer? I don't know the answer. If it's written on your heart, why don't you know the answer? Ask a child in the street. Do you know, what do you know about God? What do you know about God's ways? Most of the time they won't be able to tell you, because it hasn't come into effect yet. And another thing about Christianity is that it makes morality irrelevant. That bothers me. It bothered me even as a child. There was a very nice lady that lived across the road from us. Her name was Mrs. Davenport. She was the type of lady who always had an open home. My parents worked, so the long summer holidays, I was always at home alone. Mrs. Davenport always invited me to her home. She always was making homemade cookies. She always was doing nice things. And she had she was a very like old-fashioned, like Hamish type of mother. But she didn't believe in Jesus. She didn't believe in Christianity. But you would never have found a kinder, nicer person. And it bothered me. Why was she going to burn in hell? She was a nice person. She did nice things. She helped other people. She always told the truth. She never stole anything. But she didn't believe in Jesus. What was her righteousness? According to the Christian message, her good deeds were filthy rags. Is this God? Let me tell you, it's not God. One last thing. I want to show you and help you to understand the difference. The difference, I believe, between Christianity, or one of them, and Judaism, I think a lot of people are attracted to it because you don't have to be responsible for your actions. It's really a very childish religion, because it's like, if you mess up, there, don't worry about it. Jesus will take care of it. It doesn't matter. What does Judaism say? Let me explain. You know, Judaism doesn't say if you spilled the milk that you have to be booted out of the house because you did something wrong. Judaism says, okay, you spilled the milk, now here's the rag, clean it up. Okay? That's all. We have to take responsibility for our actions. And if we mess up, God is always waiting to help us to repair it. And what I want to point out to everyone is, whether you are Jew or non-Jew, no matter what you believe, God is kind. God is long-suffering and merciful. And God hears the prayer of all living. If we will but turn to Him, we do not need an intermediary. We can go straight to God, and God will hear us and help us. And I want to leave that message with you this evening. I hope that I've not been offensive in any way, but that I've just shared with you the deepest feelings of my heart, that God is good and God is kind. And there is a right way for us, all mankind, to live our lives. And I believe if every one of us, no matter whether we are Jew or Gentile, will turn to Him and look to God for help, then we will bring goodness, peace, light on earth that we never dreamed was possible. And in our day, I believe we will see the ultimate redemption and peace on earth.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.